Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love, and I'm here today with my special co-host, Jill Jenkins, who's been on the show in the past, and I'm very glad to have you with us today, Jill. I'm in Florida with you today in Fort Orange, having a good time the past week with you and your partner, Love Mecca. It's been, it's been real here. I mean, just having a great time with both of you. And
thank you.
I just got back from Costa Rica. I was working on an adventure series film with a bunch of life coaches, great group of people. And last week we had an interview with Jen and Ben Rhodey, about an off-grid self-sustainable living community being built there, a very large one. And we had a great time talking about moving between 3D reality and 5D, and how to play the game of life and how to sort of move beyond the matrix. And before that, we had an interview with a friend of yours, Jill Eaglehart, who was talking about ascension or dissension. And so we were going to continue with that, but we've been sort of, as we do on Universal Soul Love, we tend to go from topic to topic, but they're all very related. And you know, because we have a broad audience that
includes... We're an explorative bunch.
We really are. And, you know, Lana's not available, but this is great to have you with us again at this time. And
it's a pleasure.
Yeah. We have a lot of activists in our listening audience and a lot of light healers, I guess, and all kinds of people. So today we have our very special guest who I'm very excited to have on Universal Soul Love, Derek Jensen, who's an author and a social activist and an environmental activist. And I know that's a controversial word for many people in the world, but not here in Universal Soul Love, where we like to, like you said, explore everything. And we like to leave all options on the table. And we like to just exchange and share information. So, and I think this is BBS Radio is a great place to do it, and on some of our other radio networks. So glad to have you with us, Derek. Thank you for being on Universal Soul Love as our special guest today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Yes, really exciting. So could you please just give us an overview of your background and what kind of things you're doing and how you became an author and some of your ideas and values and message you're promoting to the world and that sort of thing? That's where we usually start out, so everybody can get to know you.
I guess that all my work is really aimed at trying to stop this culture from killing the planet. And so I'm a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and I've got, 20-some books out, basically around the questions of why do people do these, why do people commit destructive acts, and how is it that we rationalize them, and how is it that we think that they're in our best interest. And I mean, really, I guess to talk about how I got to where I am now, I mean, a lot of my work started with a couple of things when I was a kid, where one of them is my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And even as a kid, I was asking, I wasn't using this language, of course, because I was a kid, but I was asking, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And that was sort of the question that drove a lot of my childhood, is why is he doing these things? And so there's one thread began there. And then another thread began with when I was in second grade, so I guess when I was seven, a subdivision was put in next to where I lived. And I saw all these meadows and, you know, bits of these cottonwood trees and garter snakes and meadowlarks. They all lost their homes. And once again, I didn't have this language. I was only 7 years old, but I remember thinking, if they keep doing this, where will these others live? And also I remember thinking, if they keep doing this, they're going to run out of room. So once again, I didn't have the language, but in second grade, I understood you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so that sort of starts things. And then I went to high school, and then I went to college. And in college, you know, I did what people who do well in math do in high school, which is I got a degree in physics. And I didn't really like it. I went to the Colorado School of Mines, which is a very good engineering school, and I didn't enjoy it at all. And I started this habit of asking people, or hobby or something, asking people if they like their jobs, and about 90% would say no. I mean, I'd be on a bus, or I'd be, you know, if I took a taxi, or if I was just sitting somewhere, I would just have to say, so do you like your job? And about 90% said no. And I started thinking, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And that made me think, you know, really, who's in charge? And it really made me think also, you know, sort of a variation of the same question that I was asking in childhood. You know, if all this destruction of habitat and if all this activity isn't making people happy, why are they doing it? And so then let's fast forward a few more years, and I'm getting over a cold. And let's fast forward a few more years, and I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. I recognized that there are big problems in the world, and they're so big that I didn't know what to do. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I was paralyzed because all these problems are so huge. And then I realized, okay, there's this statement that my mother's grandmother used to say to my mother when my mother was a little girl, which I really liked, which is, inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, life's hard. And I know it's kind of a corny line, but it's really helpful to me. For example, you know, I've written 20-some books, but the truth is I don't write books. What I do is I write a page, because writing a book's too big. That's, my gosh, I can't write 700 pages. But I can write a page, and then I write another page, and I write another page, and then before you know it, I've got a book. So anyway, when I was in my late 20s, I wasn't doing much, and I wasn't, I wasn't doing any activism, but I knew things were wrong, and I realized, like I said, I wasn't paying enough for gas. So what I mean by that is that when I would buy gas, that doesn't cover the ecological and social costs. So for every dollar I would spend on gasoline, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization, but I didn't have any money. I was pretty poor myself, so because I didn't get a job in physics. I ended up keeping bees and trying to be a writer, and of course being a writer is a terrible way to make a living, a great way to make a life, but I wasn't making very much money. And so since I didn't have any money, I would instead pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And so if I spent $10 on gas, that means I have to do $2 worth of activism this week. And I started off writing letters to the editor, or there was a circus going to be in town. I knew circuses were bad, but I didn't know why. But, I mean, what the heck? I went down, and they gave me a sign, and I held the sign, and I didn't let my ignorance get in my way. I just, you know, if somebody would come up and say, why are circuses bad? I would say, ask the person next to me. I just knew they were bad, and I later understood why. But, and then I did anti-fur demos, and I did some anti-war demos, and then from there, I started working on forest protection, and pretty quickly I was having so much fun doing the activism that I stopped keeping track. But the point is, I got off my behind and actually started doing something doing something good. So there's a quick overview of how I got here, and I mean, we can either talk about where here is, or we can talk about whatever else you want. So in my late 20s, I wasn't doing much activism, and you know, the problems we faced were so large, I didn't know where to get started. And so then I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline, and by which I mean that the amount I was paying for the gas wasn't covering the social and ecological costs. So I decided that for every dollar I spent on gasoline, I would also then give a dollar to a local environmental organization. But I didn't have any money, because I quit physics and engineering, and I was a beekeeper and a writer, and neither of those you make very much money. So since
That's
I didn't have any
mix.
Money, it's the cliche about writing is it's a great way to make a life and a terrible way to make a living, and it's really
For
true.
Sure.
But anyway,
fortunately,
so I was,
that seems to be with many things that are of the passion that follow a passion. You know.
Yeah, I love writing and speaking. It's one of my favorite pastimes. Unfortunately, it doesn't. It's a good passion.
Yeah,
keep going.
Yeah, so I wasn't making any money at it, so I didn't have the money to spend the extra, you know, to give the extra money to the environmental organization. So what I decided to do is just to pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And so if I spent $10 on gas, that means that I would have to do 2 hours of activism that week. And I started off by writing letters to the editor, and then I started doing anti-circus demos and anti-fur demos and anti-war demos, and then I moved from there to, I moved from there to doing forest protection work. And pretty quickly I was having I was enjoying the activism enough that I just stopped keeping track, and really that's been my life direction ever since. And the important thing here is that I found something that was, there were things that were wrong, and I started working to try to get them right. Because the big distinction is not between the people who think there needs to be violent revolution and people who don't think there needs to be violent revolution. And the big distinction is not between those who think we can work within the system or those who think we can't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so, really, that was about just getting myself off my behind and getting to work. Because that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. So let's just roll up our sleeves and get to it.
Well, and it's interesting, on this show, there seems to be such a diversity of opinion on what's most effective in dealing with the global issues, which is often what we talk about on this show. We talk about global warming and the economy and extinction of species and all sorts of things. And some people, because we have people who are healers and we have people who are social activists, there tends to be a great disparity between what's most effective and what constitutes a positive solution. And some people believe that just sending out positive thoughts to the universe will somehow, and I do believe this is true, that thoughts are the fabric of the universe, it's the architecture of the universe, and certainly it's the foundation and it's the blueprint and it's what the intention is, what creates or manifests reality. However, I do believe there's a lot of energy that needs to be put into creating our desired reality and desired outcomes. So I don't think it's an either or, and I think that they just play a very important role, and what you're doing is very important. So, and I hope we're keeping on topic with that.
Yeah, I really love the idea of, you know, not allowing, when you were discussing how, you know, okay, I want to give back, but I don't have the money to personally do this, but I'm not gonna, instead of letting that stop you, you found a way to make that work. You know, okay, I'm gonna use my time, because my time would be worth money somewhere else. You know, I could be paid for that, and I'm gonna dedicate that. So you didn't, you know, where it could have been a barrier for some people, I think that's admirable, that and pretty cool that you found it to make a whole kind of a movement out of that.
It's excellent. I mean, you actually, you don't use money as an obstacle or as an excuse. You just pushed forward. And I think that's, I love to talk about the spiritual warrior mentality or attitude, and you really have that, and that's really impressive. Just thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all that. And there's a point to be made here, which is that, you know, I mentioned early on that my father's very violent. And in my late 20s, I was calling myself a writer, but I wasn't doing a lot of writing because when I would go to write, you know, writing is, for me at least, is a very emotional process, and it's very it's cutting to the truth of things and trying to articulate the things that I know in my heart to be true, but to which I've not yet put words. And so that was a very soulful process, and it was way too scary at first. And I remember one day thinking in my late 20s, you know, this is just too hard. And I always wanted to be a writer, but this is just too hard because I was abused, and so I can't do it. And then I had the thought, which is one of the most important thoughts I've ever had in my life, which is, you know, I can go the rest of my life with the best excuse in the world for not doing what I want to do, or I can do what I want to do. And
Wow. That
was... And this is true for no matter what our circumstances are, you know, whether it's, you know, I also have Crohn's disease, and I can say, well, I can't do that because I have Crohn's disease. And it's like, well, and sometimes that's valid if I don't really want to do it. But if it's a really important thing, it's like, well, okay, let's do it. And
it's your choice, ultimately, yeah. And that's taking the control and the reins. And we all have an opportunity to do that, regardless of, you know, what could and does hold us back at times. But, I mean, that's wonderful and just...
It is, because it's about the human spirit overcoming adversity. And we're certainly, universal soul love is really all about personal growth, and it's about empowering people to focus on what you can do as opposed to what you can't do. And it's certainly about relationships, I think, in general, for me. So I'm certainly, I completely understand what you're saying and appreciate it, too. And that you're making an excellent point on that. And so can you tell us a little more about your books and about the types of ideas that you're promoting or acting on?
Well, I think on a tangible level, one of the things that I write about pretty extensively is that this culture is functionally unsustainable. And so when I first became an environmental activist, I started hanging out with my friend John Osborne, my mentor, John Osborne, who I remember we were sitting at dinner one night, and he drew on the tablecloth a small circle, and then he put a bigger circle around it, and he said the small circle is a city, and the bigger circle is the area that it needs to exploit in order to get its resources. And excuse me, I'm just getting over a pretty bad flu. Anyway, he said that as the city expands, it will take from an ever larger area, and that cities are inherently unsustainable because they require the physical resources be brought in. And so central to all my work is the idea that this way of living is functionally unsustainable. And there have been humans who have lived sustainably. I live on Talawa Indian land here in what is now Northern California. And the Talawa were carbon dated to 12,500 years ago. They lived here for at least 12,500 years. And they lived just since the beginning of time, if you believe the Talawa instead of carbon dating. But in either case, they lived here for a long time. And when the first Europeans arrived here, they were the place was a paradise. The Klamath River was, quote, black and roiling with salmon. And the dominant culture has been here about 200 years, and the place is pretty trashed. And so the question that I ask with a lot of my work is, so what are the differences in the ways that we live? What are the ways that cause this dominant culture to act the way it does? And in different books, I've approached this from different levels. In A Language Older Than Words, I talked about how I think that we have an entire, and you can just choose any of these you want me to talk about. In A Language Older Than Words, I talked about how I think we have an entire culture suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And what PTSD does to people, or complex PTSD, Judith Herman talked about the difference between somebody being traumatized once, like if you're in an earthquake, versus somebody being actually in captivity, like a prisoner or a victim of domestic violence, where you're actually raised or kept for years in captivity. And one of the things she talks about that happens is that it deforms your ability to perceive relationships, that you start to perceive all relationships as hierarchical and not as fully mutual. And so I think we have an entire culture suffering from complex PTSD. And one of the things I say about that is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. So that Westerners perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. You know, there's this tree I'm looking at outside the window, and it is a being with as much to say as you have or I have, and with a life just as valuable to it as yours is to you and mine is to me. And that's an entirely different way to look at the world, where you perceive the world consisting of this giant symphony of voices, and our role is to figure out what role we're supposed to play in this symphony. So the way life is supposed to work is not that the violinists, you know, kill the oboe players and take their seats. But instead, we figure out how this whole orchestra is supposed to play together. And another way to look at that is there's this great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you're going to treat them another. And if when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. The same is true for women, of course, which is one of the big, big problems I have with pornography, is if when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. And if when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. So language, a language older than words, my book is really about how, like I said, the entire culture is suffering from PTSD, and that a lot of our discourse is formed by, R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, and I think there are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And the three rules of a dysfunctional family are: rule A is don't. And rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this meant is within my family, we could talk about anything we wanted except for the violence we had to pretend wasn't happening. And then we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence that wasn't happening, that we had to pretend wasn't happening, and so on. And so on a larger scale, too, you know, we can talk about anything we want, you know. How about those Chicago Cubs? They're doing great so far this year. But we can't talk about, you know, the fact that the oceans are dying, or we can't talk meaningfully about that. We can't talk about the fact that this way of life is functionally, inherently unsustainable. So that was one book. And I'll jump to the book. I've got a book coming out in a couple of weeks I think it's pretty exciting, which is called The Myth of Human Supremacy. And that book talks about what I think is the biggest problem facing humans, facing the planet today, which is the belief that humans are fundamentally separate from and superior to everybody else on the planet. Yeah, so we have an entire culture suffering from complex PTSD, where part of one of the things that happens when you are suffering from complex PTSD is that you begin to perceive all relationships as fundamentally hierarchical and based on the strong exploit the weak and not as being fundamentally mutual. And this is really important because it affects how we perceive not just our intra-human relationships, but our relationship with everyone. And one of the examples of this is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. So Westerners will perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. There's a tree just outside this window here, and this tree, the tree's life is as valuable to it as mine is to me and yours is to you. And it is as sentient and as alive as you are and as I am. And everyone is alive and everyone is speaking. And it's like we believe that the world consists, that the world is like a game of Monopoly or Risk, where the idea is to take over the whole board, as opposed to life being like a symphony where what you're supposed to do in your life is to figure out to how to play your proper role and to sing at the proper time. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And this is really important because if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them differently. If I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. The same is true for women. This is one of the many problems I have with pornography, is that if when you look at women, you see orifices, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at women, you see women, you'll treat them another way. And if when you look at this particular woman, you see this particular woman, you'll treat her differently still. And that, you know, a lot of that is my book, Language Older Than Words. I talked about how the culture is unsustainable psychologically that way, that we're all suffering from this complex PTSD. And then I go through different aspects of this in different books. And one I want to mention right now is a book I got coming out in a couple of weeks called The Myth of Human Supremacy, which is, I think, the biggest problem facing the world today is the human belief that we are fundamentally superior to and separate from everybody else. And, for example, you know, I was talking about this tree here. It ends up that plants communicate through using scents, through using chemicals. And they will, like if a caterpillar is chewing on one leaf, this tree might send out messages to other trees saying, change the composition of your leaves to make them so they don't taste good to these caterpillars.
And yeah, it'll actually attract, it'll send a pheromone out to attract the predator to that caterpillar for up to like 5 kilometers or something, I think. I read something similar.
No kidding.
Yeah, I've really been into that whole theory and idea. And through the fact that through the soil and things, they can communicate to each other too, the
microorganisms or?
Yeah, through the mycorrhizal fungi.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. Yeah, I mean,
in a sense, more intelligent than we are. And if we could just respect, and they know when the storms are coming, they know when things are going to change because they're breathing the air that we're breathing too, and then it's all kind of traveling and sending messages.
They operate on a more fundamental intelligence, a divine intelligence or universal intelligence that we can't perceive, and we have no idea. And in my book, I wrote about, I think it was either the first truth, I believe it was the illusion of the body, I had used a lot of ideas from, and I referred a lot to The Secret Life of Plants and the work of John Baxter, just talking exactly what you're talking about, that innate intelligence that's pervasive in the universe. And I did a lot of studying of consciousness and realizing that, you know, again, we're all one source and consciousness is all the same and it's all interrelated. And we just don't realize that we have this veil.
And well, if we only see a dollar bill when we see a tree, we're not ever going to unlock the secrets to this intricate, woven, beautiful communication system that is there.
No, we're blind to the hidden mysteries of the universe.
Well, we can't be. But
we don't have to be. That's right. It's all very, we do have this superiority complex. We do, just like you're saying in your new book. So I appreciate everything you're saying. I know Lana Lovewood as well. She actually helped me find your organization, which I will probably get into a little bit. But that's fantastic. I love everything you're saying. It's just really interesting conversation that we're having. So please continue. Sorry to interrupt you with that line of thought.
Well, there's a couple things. One of them is that they've done studies. I guess there's 3 things. One of them is they've done studies where they take a small tree in the understory of a forest, and they take the tree out of the forest and they put it in a greenhouse and they give it the exact same amount of light that it got in the forest and it dies. And so they start asking why this is the case, and ends up that fungal network connects the trees in the forest, and it will, I don't know who is making these decisions, whether it's the trees or the fungi or all of them together, but they will move food from the trees who have more food than they need over to the trees in the understory who aren't getting enough food. And they'll shuffle food around like that. Go ahead.
Oh, I've often read and talked to some Native American friends that say there's always it's the oldest trees in the forest that communicate through the mycorrhiza. And sometimes even the tree stumps of deceased trees I've read that are left behind, the really ancient, you know, they kind of even still have older knowledge that they're able to share and communicate through there. So, and I don't know which is making the call, but it's definitely an interesting, and I think we're just barely scratching the surface of it, to be honest.
That's definitely true.
I
agree that we're barely scratching the surface. And the next thing I wanted to bring up about this is a question that was asked by some scientists that I thought was really absurd and shows everything that's wrong with this culture, which is there were these scientists who were saying that they didn't believe that the plants would send off pheromones to help other plants prepare for the caterpillars or whatever, because they were saying, why would these plants expend the energy to help their competitors? And that's the problem right there, is the belief that they're competitors.
Right there, yeah.
I change one word, and it's like, why would they spend the energy to help their neighbors? And that's it. They're their neighbors. And it's also because they understand.
We think that if I gain something, that means you have to lose something. But maybe if it's good, you know.
It's more like the Three Musketeers.
It can be good for everybody.
If it's good for one, it's good for all. It's good for the entire community.
It shouldn't have to degrade another person for me to
better myself.
Yeah,
you know?
The old corporate ladder mentality. Yeah. Sure.
And it, excuse me. And it, it also, there's the understanding that the plants obviously have that, for example, a redwood forest. I live in a redwood forest, and the redwood forest doesn't just consist of redwoods. It also consists of cedars and alders and willows and firs. And so they understand that, that it's not that they're supposed to try to take over everything, but instead just participate. And then the last thing I wanted to say, or we can say more later, but the next thing I wanted to say about this that I think is helps me understand why a lot of people can't understand this is there's a great line by Upton Sinclair, which is, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would change that a little bit to say it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it, such that one of the reasons that we have such a hard time understanding all of this connectedness is because if we disconnect from it, it allows us to exploit them more easily. And it allows us to maintain this way of life without, I mean, one of the my favorite things that I wrote in that book a long time ago, Language Older Than Words, is that before you can exploit somebody, you have to silence them. And it's much more convenient to exploit somebody you consider as your inferior than it is to, if you actually perceive yourself as harming another individual, it's much harder to harm that individual than if you have it rationalized because, oh, it's okay to enslave them because they're Africans, because they're black. It's okay to pay women less because they're women, they're inferior. You know, if you can declare others to be inferior, then it's much easier to exploit them.
That's true. My own theory on this is the separate but equal theory of consciousness, which means that although we perceive ourselves as separate from one another, all things, all living things and all things in general, we're not. We're connected, and we depend on everything for our existence, and therefore everything is equal for that reason. And I guess that's a difficult concept for people to accept because we have never had that kind of way of thinking in quite a while, I guess, most of us.
Do you think that some people may have a little trouble coming around to understanding the interconnectedness of everything? Because if... you know, it's been so generational and for so long that we as humans have kind of been dominating over things and kind of separating ourselves from nature and in our modern society. Do you think that, in a sense, people are afraid of losing part of their identity or, you know, because it feels like, you know, if you've always known yourself to be one thing, it's kind of scary to jump off and go, you know what, I'm equal to that slug. You know, that might feel a lot strange to people.
I'm too special for that. I'm intelligent.
I would love to explore ways to kind of like, you know, I don't know. It's not necessarily an egoic thing, but it would feel dysphoric. It would feel like I'm not me, you know, and sure. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but it's a fact of the matter. I think that would be a stumbling point.
Identity is probably a difficult issue for people, which is why Anonymous exists, I think, in a way. Many people in Anonymous are activists, and I think there's probably a philosophy behind that of oneness. I know there is. So,
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and I think that it's absolutely crucial, actually, that we do... a lot of what we don't want to give up is this idea. It's like, I think that our egos are fragile enough and are, you know, narcissists generally don't have an inflated sense of self. The truth is they have they have a sense of inferiority, which means that they have to sort of puff it up to try to compensate. Mm. And I think that it, what you said about slugs is really interesting because in the example I was going to use is that in the new book, I talk about this woman who was killing slugs, and so she did some research into their neural system because she wanted to convince herself that they actually don't feel pain when she puts salt on them, which is, of course, absurd. But the point I want to get at is she has this line in there where she says that their nervous system is actually somewhat similar to our own. And then she puts in a parenthetical comment, which is not good for the old ego. And my response to that in the book, I talked about that, and then my response to it was, yeah, it's not good for the ego if your identity is based on having absolutely nothing in common with anybody else on the planet. Mm. And, I mean, I can't imagine having an ego that is so insecure that I feel emotionally threatened to learn that I have a nervous system in common with other beings. I mean, that's just nuts. And so, yeah, I completely agree with you that part of the problem...
Yeah, I think we need to discuss it and think about it, because I think most people, that's going to be a tripping point. And whether it's good or bad, you know, if it's there, it's something that will have to be overcome at some point.
The ego is a very deep topic. I know the ego likes to fight for its existence.
The ego is a great backseat passenger, but a terrible driver.
Yeah, you've got to subdue the ego. It's not, but anyhow, that's a deep philosophical discussion.
Well, I think part of the problem is that we have made our identity be based on the idea that we are superior to others, as opposed to identity being part of a team, as it were. And if your identity is based on, it's really problematical because we base our identity on this idea that we're superior to others, and then how do we validate that superiority? The way we have to validate that is by violating them. You know, the reason we know we're superior to great apes is because there's a lot of us and we're taking their habitat. The reason we know we're superior to trees, for example, is because we can cut them down and they don't cut us down. That's based on the notion that the fact that you generically, I'm not saying you too or specific listeners, but we as a culture, we base our notion of superiority on the fact that we are able to violate these others. And then one of the problems with this is that there's always new others that have to be violated then, because every new person, every new being we encounter is a new threat to our to our, you know, fragile ego in this. Another part of this is that I remember a few years ago I heard this interview with an astronomer, and somebody asked him, so why do we have to explore Mars? And the astronomer answered, because this will answer the most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we are on an entire planet of all these extraordinary intelligences, and he's asking if we're all alone. And that's why that sense of violation keeps happening, because you have to keep reinforcing the notion that you're all alone. I mean, you have to keep reinforcing the notion that you're superior, and that's very difficult when all these others are showing every moment that we aren't. It's a very,
so
very...
Maybe to promote the idea that it's great and to be part of a bigger identity is a good start, you know?
Stop looking without and start looking within. And if you start looking within, you'll realize how connected you are to the universal intelligence or whatever name you want to give to it.
To replace that identity of being superior with the identity of being part of a superior great machine, you know, of a greater whole.
I think you need to look within inside yourself and start looking at your own thoughts and feelings and beliefs and values and really start owning up to your stuff and what you stand for, and you can start actually connecting with the greater universe that's there, that's present all the time. But
I don't think it matters. I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately it doesn't matter if you go inside to go out or if you go outside to go in. I think that both of those will take you to the same place. Okay. I think you can go inside and you can start feeling all those connections, the universal connections. I think another thing that one can do is go outside and sit by a pond and watch the tiny tadpoles down in the water and watch and see how they're all connected and watch them over time. I think it doesn't really matter which path you take on that. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I think
that they all end up at the same place because it's all true.
sort of all roads lead to Rome in a sense, in the way that we're
all
talking
about. All roads lead away from Rome in this case.
Oh, yeah, that was the first thing. David's visiting here from Australia. I'm in Florida. That was the first thing I did. I've got a couple trees that are they're living beings. They're the grandmothers of that forest. I said, I'm going to take you to an enchanted forest.
Yeah, and you did. And
it's just it's therapy for me and a lot of people. And that's, you know, it's one of the many paths we can take.
And it's interesting. Some people will, you know, when it comes to the idea of, I don't know, a lot of people believe trees are alive and trees have spirits, and but then what's the difference between a tree and the life force and intelligence of a carrot, for instance? I mean, why do we differentiate between a slug and a monkey or anyhow? I don't know. That's I don't think it's a simple philosophical
debate. I think they all are actually different, and I think that's one of the things I think is really crucial. Actually, is that they all have a life force, and they're all sentient, but they are all unimaginably different from us. That the world, the world from the perspective of a tree is going to be radically different than the world from the perspective of you, even bees, honeybees. Right. You know, honeybees see, they don't see red, but they see ultraviolet. And when when you look at flowers under ultraviolet, you'll see like little arrows pointing to where the bees are supposed to go. They look radically different. The world looks radically different just with that one little change. And the same is true for, there are people who talk about trees. This is plant scientists. This is not, you know, the sort of cosmic stuff. But there are sort of plant scientists, for what it's worth, who talk about plants having like 25 different senses. And I don't know what they are. You know, the world would be radically different if you communicated entirely through pheromones than if you communicate primarily through sound waves as we do.
Or that you're stationary as opposed to ambulatory, that you're in the same spot forever and the world's moving around you.
So maybe the the differences.
Absolutely. That's the crucial thing, is to appreciate. But the slug is just as alive and just as sentient as you or me, but its worldview is entirely different, and it's unimaginable to us because we're not slugs. That doesn't mean it's any less special. And by the way, this doesn't mean that nobody ever killed anybody, because of course they do.
Everything's a value judgment on our part anyhow, and everything we do is just giving meaning to everything and judgments to everything, and it's only our meaning and our judgments anyhow. So we need to just appreciate everything that we see rather than anyhow. Yeah, great. And
well, that's
can I just
the question
ask you,
how the real question, I think, is how does this play out in the real world? And that's one of the problems with this exploitative mindset, is that it leads to exploitation. And a mindset based on perceiving these others as being centered in relationship with that. Once again, the Tala lived here for 12,500 years. And I'm not saying that they were perfect. I'm not saying that anybody's perfect. What I'm saying is that they lived here for 12,500 years, and they lived here, that means they were living sustainably. And so as the oceans are collapsing and as the world being dismantled, I would think it would behoove us to ask, what are other ways to live where people have lived sustainably, and why, and what are those differences? So I think yes, we do make value judgments. I completely agree. And that's the question becomes, what stories will lead us to live in ways that are actually beneficial to the land? And what stories will teach us to live in ways that harm the land, and then to try to change those stories? I think that's absolutely crucial, which is one of the very important things that I think you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Can we move on to maybe just talk about the global issues a little bit more and what you think we can do about this in a real practical way, too, not just sort of the philosophical or ideological aspects of it, which are very important as well.
Sure.
Maybe you
can
talk about
Ukraine
resistance as well. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I said, do you have a question or do you want me to just dive in?
Sure, yep, dive right in. I'm happy to hear about your organization, Deep Green Resistance, and what's going on with that.
Here's part of my fundamental understanding is if space aliens had come down to the planet and they were vacuuming the oceans and they were changing the climate and they were putting carcinogens in every mother's breast milk and they were toxifying the whole planet and they were making it so there's more plastic in the oceans than there is phytoplankton, I think we would know exactly what to do. We would take down the entire alien infrastructure that is allowing them to wage war against the planet. And so a lot of my work is based on that understanding. I'm going to back up for a second and say another thing that so many indigenous people have said to me is the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what they mean by that is to break our identification with the system and to instead identify with the real living earth. So that it's like a joke I tell about this, which is true, is a friend of mine called up and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? And I looked around and I said, we're in Afghanistan? I thought we're in Northern California. My friend said, how much longer do you think we're going to have troops in Afghanistan? I said, I got troops? I didn't know I had troops. He said, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. And she hung up. And the point is that that's not we. It's not our system. It's like George Monbiot, who writes very, very good stuff, in one of his essays, he said something about how can we get the energy that we need to run our brick factories? And I find that really problematical because I want to change a couple words in it and say, how do the capitalists get the energy that they need to run their brick factories? They're not my brick factories. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I think we need to do is to, it's like another way that this happened was maybe a year ago. My mom was, we were watching some news about, United States torturing. My mom said, oh, this is so terrible that we torture. I looked at her and said, Mom, you torture? I didn't know it. That's terrible. And she said, look, I'm 83 years old. Don't do this to me. I'm your mother. And the point is that it's not we.
We're identifying with it. We need to stop that.
Exactly. So that's so we need to break the identification, and then I think we actually need to go after the ability of the capitalists to destroy the planet. We need to, when I talk about bringing down civilization, what I mean is destroying the capacity of the rich to exploit the poor and destroying the capacity of the powerful to destroy the world. And sometimes because I say we need to use any means necessary to protect life on the planet, which is, I can't believe I'm called a radical for saying that, because this is the only planet that has any life that we know of. And this is the planet that gave us life. And you would think that using any means necessary to protect this planet would not be a radical statement. But anyway, a lot of times because I say that, people will say, oh gosh, he's the violence guy. And that's not true at all. Because what I mean when I say use any means necessary, I mean actually get off our behinds and do something. And what I mean by this is, the frogs aren't nearly so loud near where I live as they were 10 or 15 years ago. And so what I do, I found out why they're dying, and they're dying because the ozone layer is weakened, allows more UVB through, which weakens the egg sacs of some species of frogs. And so what I do is every week I get in the pond that's right near my house, and I collect these egg sacs, I bring them into the house, I let them hatch, and I put them back in the pond. So what I mean by what any means necessary is I mean actually doing the work. And yes, on a larger scale, I know that protecting these particular frogs is not going to help. So what needs to happen is the whole system needs to come down. And that doesn't mean everybody needs to do that. We need everything. We need people. Go ahead.
If you get your frogs in your area and somebody protects the frogs in their area and does a little other thing, whatever their surroundings necessitate, all doing little bits, though, it would definitely add up into something huge.
That would be a good start. And then we still have the problem of the functional problems, but this is still a start, and people can work their way toward it. It's like my friend John Osborne said to me when I first became an environmentalist, a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because once you ask, why is this particular piece of ground being destroyed, you start asking, why do we have an economic system that destroys land? And then once you ask that question, you ask, well, when did this economic system begin? And then you ask, well, are there other ways to live? And you know, once those questions start, then they go out like cracks in ice or cracks in glass. And that's what needs to happen. We need to start those questions and then move out from there.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. And we deal with the global issues on the show every week. And, you know, this is universal soul love. We believe in universal love and nonviolence and peace. And at the same time, I've been an investigator for more than 20 years, and I believe in self-defense. I believe in protection of the innocent, of all living creatures. And I believe that I have no tolerance for abuse, or any kind of mistreatment, and that there's just a very clear line in those situations that you don't violate. And the things that are going on just equate to murdering the planet. It's just genocide. And I'm not trying to be dramatic here. I'm just seeing what's happening and calling it what it is. I don't know exactly what all the causes are. There's all sorts of disinformation and propaganda, and I don't examine each what they call conspiracy theories coming through. I don't know. It seems to be a little bit of truth to a lot of things that I see, that I read. But in any case, I do understand what you're saying and appreciate that. And Lena often talked about something called sacred activism, and I can't remember exactly who the author was of that started that principle, but it sounds a lot like what you're saying, what's going on with what you're doing with Deep Green Resistance, and I think it's an important role.
Well, thank you. And it might have been Starhawk. She talks a lot about sacrality and also about activism, so she might be the one with sacred activism. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think the question we need to ask with our actions and with anything we do is the world a better place because of this? And by which I don't mean, that's another thing that we need to do about breaking our identity. When people say, I don't know if this happened to you when you were in college, but when I was in college, people would say, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what they meant was, by real world, they meant get a job. And I mean, when I talk about the real world, I'm talking about the real physical world. That doesn't mean we don't have to make money in capitalism. We do. We've got to pay rent because of this whole wretched system. But leave that aside for a minute. The question is, you know, are you actually making the world a better place, the real physical world? Do frogs, do they benefit by your presence? And that can include humans too, of course. And this is where we come back to what I was saying at the very, very beginning about that's one of the good things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. But I was just talking to some college students the other day, and one of them asked, so what should I do? And I said, well, I can't really tell you what to do because I don't, for a few reasons. One is I don't know what your gifts are. I don't know what you are really good at. And he was 20, so he didn't know it either. I said, your job is to figure out what you're good at. And that's your job for the next 5 years. And so when people ask me what they should do, I always first say, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? You know, sometimes people say, gosh, Derek, you've written so many books, why don't you become an organizer? And I can't even organize my pens, you know? And also, I'm very much of an introvert in terms of real life. I can, you know, do interviews and everything. That's all great. But I remember one time when I was working with this organization that we were supposed to do a phone tree and call people in the organization, tell them about some dinner or something, I don't know what it was. And I sat there the whole evening dialing 6 numbers out of a 7-number phone number and then stopping because I was terrified to make cold calls. I just can't do it. Other people, it's no big deal. So what are the things that, you know, on the other hand, well, I'll back up a second. So what are your gifts and how can you use them to serve life? The next question is, what do you love that, you know, I know, like I have this friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run a battered women's program for the state of New York, and she's wonderful. I love her work. She is so amazing. Basically, she asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? And she's relentless. She's wonderful. Do not get on the subway with this woman. You know, it's like, she's amazing. And I would never say to her, gosh, you know, instead of working on the issue you're working on, you should be working on fracking, or you're working to protect frogs. Because she has found what she loves. She wants to stop men's violence against women, and she's going to do it, and she works on that. It's great. So excellent. What do you love? You know, whatever it is, it's under assault. And then the other question I ask, which is a more earthy way to say all this, because what do you love also could be like, you know, walks on the beach and a personal fad or something. But I was working with this wetland specialist one time, and he dug in the soil, and then he rubbed it between his fingertips, and then the color of the soil would help determine whether it's wetlands, which would help determine the level of protection it would have. And I looked at him as he's doing this, and I said, do you get off on doing this? He said, oh, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do after playing with my dogs. And I laughed, and I said, this is great, because I would hate this. This is not very fun for me. On the other hand, I totally get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. But so that's the thing, too, is find the things that people get off on doing and that they would do, and then find ways to use those particular gifts to do good. That's the key to everything, I think.
Yeah. And okay, so we only have about a minute and a half left, so I did appreciate what you said, everything you said. Fantastic. Really, really exciting interview, Jill. I'm really enjoying this a lot. Thank you. Could you please just give us your website, maybe your contact information, any information you want to give us?
How can people find your book that's coming out and find out more about what you do?
My website is www.derrickjensen.org. That's DerrickJensen.org. And the book will be out in regular bookstores, and they can get it from my website or regular bookstores or Amazon or wherever they want to get it. And that's called The Myth of Human Supremacy. And I've got a whole boatload of other books, too. If they like this one, they can certainly do the others.
I saw one called The End Game, which is a word I've used quite a bit in the past. That's good.
I think I'll be getting that one.
That's really excellent. Okay.
That's probably my most well-known book is probably End Game.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I know we have a lot more to talk about, but because of the time limitations, I think we did pretty well. So,
well,
we appreciate
you,
your time
and
your service.
Questions.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for yours.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks so much for being on the show, Derrick, and our special co-host, Jill Jenkins. And we will see you next time on Universal Soul Love. Bye for now.